This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Kingdom of Childhood. This is the last lecture, Lecture 7, which will be followed by some question and answers. Lecture 7 is given in Turkey on August 19, 1924. We will now speak about some further details of method, though, of course, in this short time, I can only pick out a few examples to give you. When we consider the whole period between the change of teeth and puberty, we can see that it divides itself again into three sections, and we must bear these in mind when we have to guide the children through those early years of school life. First, we have the age when children begin to differentiate themselves from their environment and make a distinction between subject, their own self, and object, the things that surround them in the outside world. Up to this time, it is essential for us to teach in such a way that all things inside or outside the child have a quality of unity. I have shown you how that can be done artistically. Then, in the second period, we saw how the transition to descriptions of the outside world can be made through our teaching of plant and animal life. You can treat these things in quite an elementary way up till the 12th year. The third section extends from the 12th year up to puberty, and it is really only at this time that we can pass on to lifeless nature. For it is only now that the child really begins to understand the inanimate world. We might indeed say that from the 7th year to about the 9 1/2 or 9 1/3, children take everything in with their soul. There is nothing that a child would not take in with its soul. The trees, the stars, the clouds, the stones, everything is absorbed by the child's soul life. From about 9 1/3 to about 11 2/3, children already perceive the difference between the soul quality that they see in themselves and what is merely living. We can now speak of the whole earth as living. Thus we have the soul quality and the living quality. Then, from 11 2/3 to about 14, the child discriminates between what is of the soul, what is living, and what is dead, that is to say, what is based on the laws of cause and effect. We should not speak to children of inanimate things at all before they approach the 12th year. Only then should we begin to speak about minerals, physical phenomena, chemical phenomena, and so on. We must make it clear to ourselves that this is really how things are. In the child between the change of teeth and puberty, it is not the intellect but the fantasy that is predominantly active. We must constantly be thinking of the child's fantasy, and therefore, as I have often said, we must especially develop fantasy in ourselves. If we do not do this, but pass over to all kinds of intellectual things when the children are still quite young, then they cannot go through their development rightly, even in their physical body. And much that is pathological today arises from the fact that in this materialistic age, too much attention has been paid to children's intellect between the change of teeth and puberty. We should only very gradually introduce the lifeless world when the child is approaching the 12th year, for this lifeless world must be grasped by the intellect. At this time, we can introduce minerals, physical and chemical phenomena, and so on. But even here, we should connect it up with life as far as possible. Not simply start, for instance, with a collection of minerals, but start from the earth, the soil, and first describe the mountain ranges, how they bring about the configuration of the earth. Then we can speak of how the foot of the mountains is surrounded with soil. And the higher we go, the more barren the mountains become, and the fewer plants there are. So we come to speak of the barrenness of the mountains, and point out that here there are minerals. Thus we start with the mountains and lead on to the minerals. Then, when we have given a clear description of the mountains, we can show the children a mineral and say, "This is what you would find if you were to take this path up the mountain. This is where it is found." When you have done this with a few different minerals, you can pass on to speak of the minerals themselves. But you must do the other first. Here, again, proceeding from the whole and not from the part. This is very important. For physical phenomena, also, it is just as important to start from life itself. You should not begin your teaching of physics as set forth in the textbooks of today, but simply by lighting a match, for instance, and letting the children observe how it begins to burn. You must draw their attention to all the details, what the flame looks like, what it is like outside, what it is like further in, and how a black spot, a tiny black cap, is left when you blow out the flame. And when you have done this, begin to explain how the fire in the match came about. The fire came about through the generation of warmth, and so on. Thus you must connect everything with life itself. Or take the example of a lever. Do not begin by saying that a lever consists of a supported beam at the one end of which there is a force, and at the other end another force, as one so often finds in the physics books. You should start from a pair of scales. Let the child imagine that you are going to some shop where things are being weighed out, and from this pass on to equilibrium and balance, and to the conception of weight and gravity. Always develop your physics from life itself, and also your chemical phenomena. That is the essential thing, to begin with real life in considering the different phenomena of the physical and mineral world. If you do it the other way, beginning with an abstraction, then something very curious happens to the children. The lesson itself soon makes them tired. The children do not get tired if you start from real life. They get tired if you start from abstractions. The golden rule for the whole of teaching is that children should not tire. Now, there is something very strange about the so-called experimental education of the present day. Experimental psychologists register when a child becomes tired in any kind of mental activity, and from this they decide how long to occupy a child with any one subject, in order to avoid fatigue. This whole conception is wrong from beginning to end. You can read about the truth of the matter in my books, especially entitled Riddles of the Soul, and in various lecture courses. All I will do now is remind you that the human being consists of three members: the nerve sense organism, that is, all that sustains the human being in the activity of its mind and spirit; the rhythmic organism, which contains the whole rhythm of breathing, the circulation of the blood, and so on; and the metabolic limb organism, in which everything that is metamorphosed by various substances is to be found. Now, if you take the physical development of the child from birth to the change of teeth, you will find it is specially the head organization, the nerve sense organization, that is at work. Footnote: Dr. Steiner is here speaking of the process of organic development, not of the child's mental growth. There is no question of approaching the child's intellect during this first period of childhood, when the head and nerve system is performing a function entirely different from later years. See Rudolf Steiner's title, The Education of the Child in the Light of Anthroposophy. End footnote. The child develops from the head downward in the early years of life. You must examine this closely. Look first of all at a human embryo, an unborn child. The head is enormous, and the rest of the body is still stunted. The child is born, and the head is still outwardly the largest, strongest part, and out of the head proceeds the whole growth of the child. This is no longer the case between the 7th and 14th year. Rhythm of breathing, rhythm of the blood, the whole rhythmic system is what holds sway between the change of teeth and puberty. Only rhythm. But what is the real nature of rhythm? Now, If you think a great deal, particularly if you have to study, you get tired. You get tired in your head. If you have to walk far, which is an exertion of the limb organism, you also tire. The head or the nerve sense organism and the metabolic limb organism can get tired, but the rhythmic organism can never tire. For just think, you breathe all day long. Your heart beats at night as well as in the day. It must never stop from birth to death. The rhythm of it has to go on all the time and cannot ever tire. It never gets tired at all. Now, in education and teaching, you must address yourself to whichever system is predominant in the child. Thus, between the change of teeth and puberty, you must address yourself to rhythm in the child by using pictures. Everything that you describe or do must be done in such a way that the head has as little to do with it as possible, but the heart, the rhythm, everything that is artistic or rhythmic must be engaged. What is the result? The result is that with teaching of this kind, the child never gets tired, because you are engaging the rhythmic system, not the head. People are very clever in this materialistic age, and so they have decided that children should always be allowed to romp about between lessons. Now, it is certainly good to let them romp about, but it is good because of the soul qualities in it, because of the delight they have in it. For there have been experiments made that show when the children are properly taught in lesson time, they are less tired than when they play about outside. The movement of their limbs tire them more, whereas what you give them in their lessons, in the right way, should never tire them at all. And the more you develop the pictorial element with the children, and the less you exert the intellect by presenting everything in a living way, the more you will be making demands on the rhythmic system only, and the less will the children become tired. Therefore, when the experimental psychologists come and make observations to see how much the children tire, what is it they really observe? They observe how badly you have taught. If you had taught well, they would find no fatigue on the part of the children. In our work with children of elementary school age, we must see to it that we engage the rhythmic system only. The rhythmic system never tires and is not overexerted when we employ it in the right way. And for this rhythmic system, we need not an intellectual, but rather a pictorial method of presentation, something that comes out of the fantasy. Therefore, it is imperative that fantasy should hold sway in the school. This must still be so, even in the last period of which we have spoken, from 11 2/3 to 14 years. We must still bring lifeless things to life through fantasy and always connect them with real life. It is possible to connect all the phenomena of physics with real life, but we ourselves must have fantasy in order to do it. This is absolutely necessary. Now, this fantasy should above all be the guiding principle in what are called compositions, when the children have to write about something and work it out for themselves. Here you must strictly avoid allowing the children to write a composition about anything that you have not first talked over with them. You, yourself, with the authority of the teacher and educator, should have first spoken about the subject with the children. Then the child should produce a composition under the influence of what you yourself have said. Even when the children are approaching puberty, you must still not depart from this principle. Even then, children should not just write whatever occurs to them. They should always feel that a certain mood has been aroused in them through having discussed the subject with their teacher. And all that they then write in their own essay must preserve this mood. Here again, it is aliveness that must be the guiding principle. Aliveness in the teacher must pass over to aliveness in the children. As you will see from this, all of your teaching and education must be taken from real life. This is something you often hear nowadays. People say that lessons must be given in a living way and in accordance with reality. But first of all, we must acquire a feeling for what is actually in accordance with reality. I will give you an example from my own experience of what sometimes happens in practice, even when, in theory, people hold the most excellent educational principles. I once went into a classroom where an arithmetic example was being given that was supposed to connect addition with real life. 14 2/3, 16 5/8, and 25 3/5, for example, were not simply to be added together, but were to be related to life. This was done in the following way. The children were told that one man was born on March 25, 1895, another on August 27, 1898, and a third on December 3, 1899. How old are these three men together? That was the question. And the sum was quite seriously carried through in the following way. From the given date in 1895 to 1924 is 29 3/4. This is the age of the first man. The second one, up to 1924, is about 26 1/2 years old. And the third, from 1899, as he was born on December 3rd, we may say 25. The children were then told that when they add up these ages, they will find out how old they all are together. But, my dear friends, I should just like to ask how it is possible that they can make up a certain sum together with their ages. How do you set about it? Of course, the numbers can quite well be made up into a sum. But where can you find such a sum in reality? The men are all living at the same time, so that they cannot possibly experience such a thing together in any way. A sum like this is not, in the very least, taken from life. It was pointed out to me that this sum was actually taken from a book of examples. I then looked at this book, and I found several other ingenious examples of the same kind. In many places I have found that this kind of thing has repercussions in ordinary life. And that is the important thing about it. For what we do at school affects ordinary life. And if the school teaching is wrong, that is, if we bring such an unreality into an arithmetical example, then this way of thinking will be adopted by the young people and applied in ordinary life. I do not know if it is the same in England, but all over Central Europe, when, let us say, several criminals are accused and condemned together, you sometimes read in the papers, all five together have received sentences of imprisonment totaling 75 1/2 years. One has 10 years, another 20, and so on, but it is all added up together. You find this repeatedly in the newspapers. I would like to know what meaning a sum like that can have in reality. For each single prisoner who is sentenced, the 75 years together certainly have no meaning. They will all of them be free long before the 75 years are over, so it has no reality at all. You see, what is the important thing is to make straight for the reality in everything. You simply poison a child to whom you give a sum that is absolutely impossible in real life. You must guide the child to think only about things that are to be found in life. Then, through your teaching, reality will be carried back into life again. In our time, we suffer terribly from the unreality of people's thinking. And the teacher must consider this very carefully. There is a theory today that, though postulated by people who are considered to be extraordinarily clever, is really only a product of education. It is the so-called theory of relativity. I hope you have already heard something of this theory that is connected with the name of Einstein. There is much in it that is correct, but it has been distorted in the following way. Let us imagine that a cannon is fired off somewhere. It is said that if you are so many miles away, after a certain length of time you will hear the report of the cannon. If you do not stand still, but walk away from the sound, then you hear it later. The quicker you walk away, the later you get the impression of the sound. If you do the opposite and walk toward the sound, you'll be hearing it sooner and sooner all the time. But now, if you continue this thought, you come to the possible conception, which is, however, an impossibility in reality, that you approach the sound more quickly than it travels itself. And then, if you think this out to its conclusion, you come to the point of saying to yourself, then there is also a possibility of hearing the sound before the cannon is fired off. This is what it can lead to if theories arise out of a kind of thinking that is not in accordance with reality. A person who can think in accordance with reality must sometimes have very painful experiences. In Einstein's books, you will find, even for instance, how you could take a watch and send it out into the universe at the speed of light, and then let it come back again. We are then told what happens to this watch if it goes out at the speed of light and comes back again. I should like to see the actual watch that, having whizzed away at this speed, then comes back again. I should like to know what it looks like then. The essential thing is that we never lose sight of reality in our thinking. Herein lies the root of all evil in much of the education of today. And you find, for instance, in the exemplary kindergartens, that different kinds of work are thought out for the child to do. Exemplary was in quotes. In reality, we should not allow the child to do anything, even in play, that is not an imitation of life itself. All frivol occupations and the like, which have been thought out for the children, are really bad. You must make it a rule only to let the children do what is an imitation of life, even in play. This is extremely important. For this reason, as I have already told you, we should not provide what are called, quote-unquote, ingenious toys. But, with dolls or other toys, we should leave as much as possible to the child's own fantasy. This is of great significance. And I earnestly beg you to make it a rule not to let anything come into your teaching and education that is not in some way connected with life. The same rule applies when you ask the children to describe something. You should always call their attention to it if they stray from reality. The intellect never penetrates as deeply into reality as fantasy does. Fantasy can go astray, it is true, but it is rooted in reality, whereas the intellect remains always on the surface. That is why it is so infinitely important for the teacher to be in touch with reality as he or she stands in the class. To support this, we have our teachers' meetings in the Waldorf School, which are the heart and soul of the teaching. In these meetings, all the teachers speak of what they, as individuals, have learned from their classes and from all the children in them, so that each one learns from the other. No school is really alive where this is not the most important thing, this regular meeting of the teachers. And indeed, there is an enormous amount one can learn there. In the Waldorf School, we have mixed classes, girls and boys together. Now, quite apart from what the boys and girls say to each other, or what they consciously exchange with each other, there is a marked difference to be seen in the classes according to whether there are more girls than boys or more boys than girls, or an equal number of each. For years I have been watching this, and it has always proved to be the case that there is something different in a class where there are more girls than boys. In the latter case, you will very soon find that you yourself, as the teacher, become less tired, because the girls grasp things more easily than boys, and with greater eagerness, too. You will find many other differences also. Above all, you will very soon discover that the boys themselves gain in quickness of comprehension when they are in a minority, whereas the girls lose by it if they are in the minority. Let me read that again. Above all, you will very soon discover that the boys themselves gain in quickness of comprehension when they are in a minority, whereas the girls lose by it if they are in the minority. And so there are numerous differences that do not arise through the way they talk together or treat each other, but that remain in the sphere of the imponderable and are themselves imponderable things. All these things must be very carefully watched, and everything that concerns either the whole class or individual children is spoken of in our meetings, so that every teacher really has the opportunity to gain an insight into characteristic individualities among the pupils. There is one thing that is, of course, difficult in the Waldorf school method. We have to think much more carefully than is usually the case in class teaching, how one can really help the children progress. For we are striving to teach by, quote-unquote, reading from the particular age of a child what should be given at this age. All I have said to you is directed toward this goal. Now, suppose a teacher has a child of between 9 and 10 years in the class that is right for its age, but without much further thought, the child is kept behind and not allowed to go ahead with the rest of the class. The consequence will be that in the following year, this child will be receiving teaching meant for children of a different age. Therefore, under all circumstances, we should avoid letting children stay behind in the same class, even if they have not reached the required standard. This is not so convenient as letting the children stay in the class where they are and repeat the work, but we should avoid this at all costs. The only corrective we have is to put the very weak ones into a special class for the more backward children. Children who are in any way below standard come into this class from all the other classes. Otherwise, as I have said, we do not let the children stay behind, but we try to bring them along with us under all circumstances, so that in this way each child really receives what is right for his or her particular age. We must also consider those children who have to leave school at puberty, at the end of the elementary school period, and who cannot therefore participate in the upper classes. We must make it our aim that by this time, through the whole tenor of our teaching, they will have come to a perception of the world that is in accordance with life itself. This can be done in a twofold way. On the one hand, we can develop all our science and history lessons in a way that the children, at the end of their schooling, have some knowledge of the human being and some idea of the place of human beings in the world. Everything must lead up to a knowledge of the human being, reaching a measure of wholeness when the children come to the 7th and 8th grades. That is when they have reached their 13th and 14th year. Then all that they have already learned will enable them to understand what laws, forces, and substances are at work in the human being itself, and how the human being is connected with all physical matter in the world, with all that is of soul in the world, and with all spirit in the world. Thus the children, in their own way, of course, come to know what a human being is within the whole cosmos. This, then, is what we try to achieve on the one hand. On the other hand, we try to give the children an understanding of life. It is actually the case today that most people, especially those who grow up in towns, have no idea how things, paper, for instance, are made. There are a great many people who do not know how the paper on which they write, or the material they are wearing, is manufactured, nor, if they wear leather shoes, how the leather is prepared. Think of how many people there are who drink beer and have no idea how the beer is made. This is really an unfortunate state of affairs. Now, we cannot, of course, achieve everything in this regard, but we try to make it our aim, as far as possible, to give the children some knowledge of the work done in the various trades, and to see to it that they themselves also learn how to do different kinds of work that are done in real life. It is, however, extraordinarily difficult, in view of what is demanded of children today by the authorities, to succeed with an education that is really related to life itself. One has to go through some very painful experiences. Once, for instance, because of family circumstances, a child had to leave when he had just completed the 2nd class and begun a new year in the 3rd. He had to continue his education in another school. We were then most bitterly reproached because he had not got so far in arithmetic as was expected of him there, nor in reading or writing. Moreover, they wrote and told us that the eurythmy and painting and all the other things he could do were of no use to him at all. If, therefore, we want to educate the children not only out of knowledge of the human being, but also in accordance with the demands of life, they will need to know how to read and write properly when this is expected of them today. And so the curriculum will have to include many things, simply because that is what is demanded by the customs of the time. Nevertheless, we must still try to relate the children to real life as much as possible. I would dearly like to have a shoemaker as a teacher in the Waldorf school, if this were possible. It cannot be done because such a thing does not fit into a curriculum based on present-day requirements. But in order that the children might really learn to make shoes and to know, not theoretically but through their own work, what this entails, I would dearly like to have a shoemaker on the staff of the school. But it simply cannot be done because it is not in accordance with the authorities, although it is just the very thing that is in accordance with real life. Nevertheless, we do try to enable the children to be practical workers. When you come to the Waldorf school, you will see that the children are quite good at binding books and making boxes. You will see, too, how they are led into a really artistic approach to handwork. The girls will not be taught to produce the kind of thing you see today when you look at the clothes that women wear, for instance. It does not occur to people that the pattern for a collar should be very different from that of a belt or the hem of a dress. People do not consider that here. For example, see drawing A, the pattern must have a special character because it is worn at the neck. The pattern for a belt, drawing B, must lead upward and downward and so on. Or again, we never let our children make a cushion with an enclosed pattern, but the pattern itself should show where to lay your head. You can also see that there is a difference between right and left, and so forth. Thus here, too, life itself is woven and worked into everything that the children make, and they learn a great deal from it. This, then, is another method by which the children may learn to stand rightly in life. We try to carry this out in every detail. For example, in giving reports, I could never, for the life of me, imagine what it means to mark the capacities of the children with a 2 or 3 or 2.5. I do not know if this is done in England, too, giving the children numbers or letters that are supposed to show what a child can do. In Central Europe, it is customary to give a 3 or a 4. At the Waldorf School, we do not give reports like this, but every teacher knows every child and describes him or her in the report. The report describes, in the teacher's own words, what the child's capacities are and what progress the child has made. And then, every year, each child receives in the report a personal motto or verse, which can be a word of guidance in the year to come. The report is like this. First there is the child's name, and then the verse. And then the teacher, without using stereotyped letters or numbers, simply characterizes what the child is like, and what progress she or he has made in the different subjects. The report is thus a description. The children always love their reports, and their parents also get a true picture of what the child is like at school. We lay great stress upon keeping in touch with the parents, so that from the school we may see into the home through the child. Only in this way can we come to understand each child, and to know how to treat every peculiarity. For instance, we may notice a trait in one child that looks the same as a trait in another child, yet the meaning of that trait may be altogether different in the one case than in the other. Suppose, for instance, that two children each show a certain excitability. It is not merely a question of knowing that the children are excitable and giving them something to help them quiet down. Rather, it is a question of finding out that one child has an excitable father who is being imitated, and that the other child is excitable because of a weak heart. In every case, we must be able to discover what lies at the root of these peculiarities. The real purpose of the teachers' meetings is to study the human being, so that a real knowledge of human beings is continually flowing through the school. The whole school is the concern of the teachers in their meetings, and all else that is needed will follow of itself. The essential thing is that in the teacher's meetings there is study, steady, continual study. These are the indications I wanted to give you for the practical organization of your school. There are, of course, many things that could still be said if we could continue this course for several weeks, but that we cannot do, and therefore I want to ask you tomorrow, when we come together, to put in the form of questions anything you may have upon your minds, so that we may use the time for you to ask your questions that I will then answer for you. The end of Lecture 7, that's the end of a set of lectures, but there is also one more addition, which will be the question and answer section.